That's why they can remain calm. So if you look at them, their faces will help reassure you and you'll stay calm too. Cusack, I'm sorry, but what the... I'm your flight attendant, Adam. I'm the one remaining calm because I'm experienced enough to know that the chances of something being seriously wrong here are between slim and none. Do you know how many people were reported missing in Ireland last year? Why would I know that? No reason at all, but it's my job to know. It was 7,743. Want to guess how many were still missing at year's end? I'm sure you're going to tell me any... 15 people, Adam. 15? 15. That's less than 0.2%. You think I don't care because when you come in here and tell me that a grown woman who lies went on a holiday and didn't come home, I don't immediately send out an international search party. But it's not because I don't care. It's not because the Gardaí aren't interested in helping you. It's because I do, and we are. I'm here telling you there's no need to panic, because all the other times my colleagues and I have heard similar stories, the outcome wasn't what you fear it will be here. But this Peter guy, I said. What about what he says? About the ship? Leaving aside my concern that you are taking as fact something you read about online and then, here Cusack made air quotes, verified by talking to a stranger over the phone, I actually can't help you there. We don't have jurisdiction. So I need to call the French police? You don't need to call any police. But if you wanted to get politely listened to for a couple of minutes and then completely ignored thereafter, you could call them, yes. But there'd be no point calling the French. The last sighting of her was on the ship, right? While it was sailing. That's international waters. Maritime law applies. Which means what? When at sea, all seafaring vessels fall under the jurisdiction of the country in which they are registered. If you get mugged in Times Square, you're not going to call the Gardaí, are you? I should hope not. You'd call the NYPD. Same wherever you are in the world. If something happens, you get the local police. But what if they're not in any country at all? What if you're at sea? That's where maritime law comes in. Who do I call then? You're still not calling anyone because it's up to the captain of the ship to invite an outside authority aboard. But if he or she did, then it would be the authority of the country where the ship itself is registered. The Celebrate is registered in Barbados. There was a beat of silence while my brain, still processing the idea that there were essentially no police at sea, caught up with what Cusack was saying. How do you know that? I said. Did you call Blue Wave? I know because of Shane Keating. Who? I would have thought the name would come up in your internet search. He was the boy who went overboard from a ship called the Fiesta a while back, another Blue Wave ship. He was just... 16, I said. Yeah. He did come up. Just not his name. Initially, they didn't know he'd gone overboard. He just disappeared from the ship. A family member contacted Gardaí in Dublin and we contacted Blue Wave. They politely told us we had no jurisdiction. He disappeared while the ship was in the North Atlantic. Blue Wave have their European headquarters in City West and their global headquarters in Florida, but the Fiesta was registered in Barbados like all Blue Wave ships. Those big cruise ships are all registered in places like that. The Bahamas, Panama, Libya, even for tax reasons. Flags of convenience, they call them. Two, what do you call them? Barbadian, is it? Two Barbadian police officers were just about to get on a plane to go meet the ship when they discovered that he'd actually gone overboard. So they called in the Icelandic Coast Guard to start search and rescue instead. Cusack sighed. So like I said, I can't help you. This is bullshit. This is procedure. Best practice based on cumulative knowledge and experience. I've been a Garda for 10 years. You've been at this a week. So, yet again, there's nothing you can do for us. I stood up to go. You know, I always thought... Well, I never really thought about it, I suppose, but in the back of my mind, I had this idea that the Gardaí would be there to help me if anything ever went badly wrong. Silly me. It's not that simple. We don't know where Sarah is. We need your resources to find her. Sounds pretty simple to me. Adam, wait. Cusack stood too. I know you're angry at us, at me, and that's fine. I get it. I really do. But I don't know how many other ways I can say it. This is how it works. We've contacted the Department of Foreign Affairs. They'll contact us the second they hear from her. We've sent out an Interpol bulletin, so if Sarah's name comes up in any police investigation anywhere in the world, whether it be a missing person or a car accident or a parking fine, we'll know about it too. So no, there aren't any police officers walking the street searching for her, but every police department in the world has an alarm on her name. We can't help you with the ship, but...
Cusack stopped.
What? What is it? I did do one thing you asked, she said. She reached into her jeans pocket and pulled out a slightly rumpled, folded piece of lined paper. I looked up that phone number. What phone number? The one that you said belonged to the guy Sarah was seeing. I glared at the piece of paper. Is that it? You could have found it yourself if you dug around online long enough. He used to have it on an old profile on a job's website. That's why I'm giving it to you. Cusack looked at me pointedly. Because you could have found it yourself. Understand? Yeah. She handed over the paper. I began to unfold it, but Cusack put a hand on mine to stop me. Listen to me for a second, Adam. His name is Ethan Eckhart. He is American and he does live in Dublin. This is an email address for him that I found. The telephone number seems to have been disconnected. A pause. And there's something else.
What?
It'll explain something for you. Go on.
What?
Why Sarah was on that ship.
She was on it with him.
I mean, why she went there with him and not, say, on a sun holiday or off to Paris on a mini break. It's a piece of the puzzle we were missing that we have now. That's the way you need to look at it, too. Just tell me.
My fingers tightened around the folded piece of paper.
Just say it.
Ethan Eckhart, Cusack said. He's on the Celebrate right now. He works there.
Part 3. The Bay of Angels. Corinne. It was mid-afternoon, and the crew mess was filling up with cabin attendants, relaxed and jovial now that they were done for the day. Corinne was too exhausted to wait in line for the hot counter, so she took a prepackaged salad from the fridge instead, a leftover from one of the cafes on board, no longer fresh enough to serve to paying passengers, but still perfectly okay to eat. She poured herself a coffee from the self-serve machine, and then, on second thought, poured herself a second one. It had been a long night with almost no sleep, and then, because of that, an even longer day. She was struggling to stay awake. She found a table at the very back of the mess, an ideal vantage point for watching other crew members join the queue for lunch. With her eyes on the faces coming through the doors, she opened her salad, forked up a piece of torn chicken breast, and put it in her mouth. It had no discernible flavor. To Corinne, it tasted like chewing gum that had been chewed for too long. Where was Lydia? That was all she could think about. Why didn't she meet me here this time yesterday? That Lydia hadn't shown up wasn't in itself that big a deal. She could easily have overslept or been called on shift earlier than usual. They had no phones to contact each other with, and anyway, it wasn't as if their meetings were anything other than a comfortable routine they'd fallen into over the past week. Lydia could have had dinner with some of her colleagues instead, spent the time with friends her own age. She was a dancer in one of the stage shows. The entertainment department had nothing but young people in it. Who would want to hang around with an ailing 60-odd-year-old French woman when there was such fun to be had? Corinne had worried that Lydia was having difficulty adjusting to life on the ship. She was just happy to see the girl settling in so well. There was no way of checking whether Lydia had gone to work. Crew weren't allowed into passenger areas while off-duty. And Corinne found it impossible to tell whether the jumble of cosmetics on the girl's bed had been disturbed since yesterday. She had checked the cabin again just now, but perhaps Lydia hadn't been there because she was showering. Which left only her absence on the crew deck this morning to explain away. Why hadn't she shown up for that? Corinne hadn't seen her cabin mate for more than 24 hours now. Not since just before she found the photograph in number 1001. Could that really be a coincidence? Or was this another message from him? She should tell someone about this. But who? And what would she even say? Surely, if Lydia hadn't shown up for her shift last night, someone would have noticed already, and... Oh, my God! Lydia's voice, then the girl herself dropping into the seat opposite. The queue for the shower room was insane, Cor! She was panting, out of breath. Her makeup had been freshly applied, and her hair was still wet at the ends. How's things? Where... Corinne was at once flooded with relief and angry at the girl for making her worry. Then she was angry at herself for being so fretful. She swallowed all those feelings and said, as cheerfully as she could, I am very well, thank you. And you?
Good. Great, actually.
Good. Are you going to have some dinner? I think I saw some pizza up there.
I will in a sec.
Lydia glanced over her shoulder.
When the line thins out a bit.
Here. Corinne pushed the extra cup of coffee across the table.
Are you sure?
Of course. It is for you.
Thanks, Cor. You're a lifesaver.
Did you start early yesterday? Lydia took a sip of her coffee.
Early?
You weren't here.
Oh, yeah. Well, Lydia blushed. I had a date.
A date? Corinne couldn't hide her surprise. Lydia seemed so young, so naive. A child out alone in the wide adult world for the first time. She couldn't imagine her out on a date. But then... Lydia was the same age now that Corinne had been when she got married. She couldn't imagine that either.
Yeah, we worked the same shifts, so that was the only time we could meet.
I see. Did you have a good time together?
A very good time, she burst out laughing. Sorry, Cor. I don't know why I'm so embarrassed to tell you this, but I am.
It is probably because I'm older than your mother, but I'm glad you had a nice time. Are you seeing him again this evening?
I think so.
Lydia's face changed.
Oh, Cor, you weren't waiting for me, were you? Out on deck this morning? Sorry, I thought that, you know, you'd be going out there anyway, and it wouldn't matter if...
I was, Corinne said, She smiled. No problem. She picked up her coffee. So, tell me about him, your new friend.
He's a security guard.
Lydia's eyes sparkled. She was clearly delighted to have an opportunity to talk about him.
His name's Luke, and he's really nice. Really good-looking, too. Fit.
Fit? Corinne was puzzled. You mean healthy?
Lydia laughed.
It does mean that, but it can also mean, like, sexy.
Now Corinne felt herself blush.
By the time you go home, you'll know all the slang, Lydia said. I'll teach you. You'll be so down with the kids. But you'll have to teach me French in exchange. If things work out with Luke, between the two of you, I might be fluent by the time I have to go home.
Corinne frowned. Between the English and the accent, it took her a second to put together what Lydia had said.
Luke is French, too?
Lydia nodded.
Yep. Funny, huh?
Yes.
The ship had very few French crew members. Indeed, Corinne had yet to meet one, and that included the crew she had encountered during the introductory training, which had been more like a convention with hundreds of people attending.
Did you tell him your cabin mate was French?
Yeah, he wanted to know where you were from. It's Lyon, right?
Yes, Corinne said absently.
Lyon.
It was the first town she had thought of when Lydia asked.
Good. I wasn't sure I got it right.
Which part of France is he from? Did he tell you?
Lydia made a face.
North of Paris, I think.
Do you know where exactly?
Corinne barely dared to ask.
Did he mention a town?
It was like Dev-O or something.
Corinne tried not to react, but she was only partly successful. Lydia mistook the dawning of horror on her face for recognition.
You know it, Cor?
Corinne nodded silently. She couldn't speak.
Adam. We're here! A sing-song voice, intruding on my sleep, tugging me awake. Sir, we are here. Closer to me now, near my ear, accented English. Sir, it's time to go. A hand on my left arm gently shaking me. I open my eyes. Sorry for waking you, sir. The Blue Wave rep had a wide, unnaturally white smile. She was young, 18 or so, with tightly curled dark brown hair, potentially Spanish. But we have arrived at the terminal. Welcome to Barcelona. She pronounced it Barcelona. Definitely Spanish, then. I began the process of freeing my limbs from the tiny space between the end of my seat and the back of the one in front. The Blue Wave shuttle from the airport was actually a fleet of spectacularly cramped minibuses, made worse by my choice of a window seat. I had taken it so I could turn my body away from the other passengers, plug in my headphones so I wouldn't have to listen to their excited chatter and pretend to be asleep. Then actually be asleep, since I hadn't slept much in the past 48 hours. Everyone else was already off the bus and moving toward the terminal building, the children running ahead while the parents yelled after them. Around me, the port was a hive of activity. Buses coming and going, luggage stacked on the same little trucks you see at the airport, people swarming everywhere. Blue Wave reps, identified by their deep blue t-shirts and aggressive friendliness, smiling and waving clipboards around. All views of the sea blocked by the enormous terminal building. A glass and exposed pipe design that had probably been considered futuristic in the 80s, but now seemed clumsy and obsolete.
A giant sign outside its doors threatened that my Blue Wave adventure starts right now. I headed that way, squinting in the midday sun. I had sunglasses in my backpack, but didn't put them on lest he not recognize me. My entire knowledge of what Peter Brazier looked like came from the photos I had seen posted online alongside stories about Estelle. And each one, he was posed happily next to her, smiling at her or holding her or kissing her or doing a combination of those things. He was about a foot taller than his wife, broad-shouldered and invariably tanned, with the strong jaw and dimpled chin of an American named Brad, who can make sound financial investments and chop wood with the same hair-flipping ease. Together, he and Estelle looked like a Ralph Lauren ad campaign, all teeth and style and effortless beauty. They had a shine to them, as if they had been polished to a high gloss. This was the image I had brought with me to Barcelona, but now, seeing him waiting for me outside the terminal doors, I realized that Peter in all those pictures was the one from his before. Estelle had disappeared a year ago. Since then, the man had gotten thin. Too thin. He was just skin and bones now, no muscle mass. The line of his jaw jutted out above a narrow bird-like neck, and his cheekbones seemed to have been pushed up and out. He had let his hair grow and become utterly unruly, curling around his ears and neck. Still light brown mostly, but running grey in parts. Peter was unshaven, sporting a beard of patchy stubble that gave the impression that he had just rolled out of bed and that the bed might have been a sheet of cardboard under a bridge. His linen pants and black t-shirt were wrinkled and misshapen, and the t-shirt had white crescents of old deodorant under the arms. His eyes were dull, the skin beneath them sagging in tones of grey and purple. The guy was a wreck. But then, maybe I would be too, if I had been feeling for the past year the way I felt for the past 10 days. 10 days. This time last week, almost to the hour, I had been at the airport waiting for Sarah. On the one hand, it seemed unfathomable that I had been living in a world that Sarah was missing from for so long. On the other hand, I couldn't believe that this nightmare was barely a week old. "Adam," he called out. He waved. "Peter, hi." We shook hands. He grasped mine tightly, pumped it twice. We looked at each other until I laughed nervously. "I don't really know what to say." "Best not to say much for the moment," Peter said. "Not until after we're aboard." "Right." The terminal's automatic glass doors slid open for us and a blast of cool air rushed out. Peter went in first. Inside, it was much like an airport. A huge hangar-like space thronged with people. A jagged white design cut in diagonal rows across a navy carpet, under the feet of hundreds of cruise-goers shuffling along inside a maze of blue ropes, waiting their turn at the many check-in desks. Anticipation and the noise of excited chatter filled the air. Peter stopped and nodded at something up ahead. "There it is." I thought he was talking about the queue to board until I lifted my head. The far wall of the terminal, the one facing the water, was made entirely of panes of glass. White coloured glass, I thought for a second, until my focus shifted and I realised what I was looking at. The panes were clear. All that white was behind them. Something gargantuan, something taller and wider than the terminal building itself. A gleaming monster that blocked out both sea and sky that couldn't even be encompassed by hundreds of window panes. The Celebrate. She was docked alongside the terminal building, which made sense now that I thought about it. We would simply check in here and walk aboard, just like that. This was really going to happen. I was about to get on the Celebrate. Or try to, anyway. Peter had concerns that one or both of our names could be flagged. I had booked two cabins, one under Peter's name and one under my own, without encountering any problems, but it might be a different story trying to physically board the ship. Peter explained that this was partly why he had never tried to go aboard before. The other reason was that he had cleaned out his bank account petitioning Blue Wave in court for access to its CCTV and then, after that failed, filing a civil suit. Either way, our tickets were non-refundable. My credit card was effectively melted down now. We flashed our tickets to a security guard manning the start of a line for customs and immigration, then showed our passports to Spanish border guards. We barely spoke while we waited. There was only one thing we wanted to talk to each other about, and we couldn't risk being overheard. Afterward, we shuffled to a check-in counter where our passports were scanned and our photos taken by a tiny camera mounted on the desk. I could feel Peter tensing beside me as the agent activated our swipe-out cards, but she said nothing to us except for an automatic sounding, "You're all set. You'll be in boarding area C." Then she handed me a blue plastic wallet and told us to enjoy our cruise. The wallet had a Blue Wave logo on it, but it was different from the one on Sarah's note. They were rebranding, I remembered the receptionist saying back at the Blue Wave office. The tickets had the waves, so this logo on the wallet, an outline of a ship, must be the one they were replacing. Up ahead, passengers were posing in front of a backdrop of the Celebrate at sea, while a professional photographer hopped around them, shouting instructions and snapping his lens. When he was done, an overly enthusiastic Blue Wave t-shirt-wearing assistant scanned the relevant swipe-out card into a handheld machine while squealing the same line every 30 seconds, like one of those dolls with a pull string on the back. "Don't forget to stop at the photo shop on the Oceanic deck, where prints start at just $9.99. "We should do it," Peter said. "Everyone does, and we don't want to stand out." So, the two of us stood in front of a picture of the ship where the women we loved had last been seen alive and gave a big smile for the camera. After that, there was one more security check where our swipe-out cards were compared to our photo IDs and our bags were scanned. Then, escalators carried us up onto the terminal's mezzanine level. Now we were alongside the first row of the Celebrate's portholes. The crowd, getting more excited, moved faster here. We flowed outside, back into the warm Spanish sun and fresh sea breeze, and there she was. Her whole side in full view now, towering above us as high as a skyscraper and as wide as a city block. I saw balconies and orange lifeboats and blue and white bunting. At her highest point, a massive yellow funnel rose up into the cloudless sky and disappeared in the glare of the sun. On her hull, "Celebrate" was stenciled in blue lettering, broken up to look like crashing waves. We made slow progress to the gangplank and then across it, through an opening in the side of the ship, close to the waterline. The queue was unrulier here. Kids jostled each other for position, a baby was squealing somewhere, and the woman behind me kept clipping my ankles with the front wheels of her baby's complicated-looking pram. It was almost a relief to step into the hole in the side of the ship. Almost. We emerged into a spacious area that looked like the lobby of a luxury hotel. Patterned carpet, low lighting, overstuffed armchairs strewn about in a way that appeared casual but was undoubtedly planned to the last inch. Ornate, polished wooden stairs curled up and out of the space past a huge watercolour of the Celebrate over the landing. Paired with the plush furnishings, the smell of seawater drifting in from the open hatch was disconcerting. A line of Blue Wave crew members, dressed in the standard blue polo shirt and beige chino combination, stood by to greet us. I looked at each face in turn. Folded in my packet was a printout of the profile page for Ethan Eckhart that Cusack had found on a website for cruise ship workers. I had stared for hours at the tiny headshot. Ethan didn't look at all like what I had expected. In my imagination, Sarah had fallen for an underwear model. Someone with the kind of honed and chiselled body that graced the covers of glossy style magazines and required endless hours in the gym and in front of a mirror, and before any of that could even begin, a winning ticket in the genetic lottery. That was why she had fallen for him, because he looked that way, because he was something so other, so different. She hadn't been able to resist him because he was irresistible. That's what I had been telling myself anyway. In reality, Ethan was perfectly ordinary. Dark hair cut close to the scalp. Not unattractive, but not especially attractive either. His thin lips parted in a half smile. It was a professional's headshot. He was wearing a suit jacket, white shirt and plain tie. He had nothing in the way of identifying marks, no standout feature, no eyewear, facial hair, piercings or visible tattoos. Whenever I closed my eyes and tried to conjure up a description that would be of use to a police sketch artist or the operator of an identikit machine, I could think of nothing more specific than blue eyes, brown hair, white skin. Still, I felt confident I would recognize him if I met him in the flesh, but none of these guys looked anything like him. When it was our turn, Peter and I found ourselves facing a guy of maybe 20, 21 years. He had a big smile and a small tablet computer with a keycard device attached to its side. His name tag told us that this was Danny and his favourite Blue Wave destination was Istanbul. "Welcome aboard the Celebrate," he sounded English. "Are you excited to experience our Mediterranean dream?" In a moment that would have been amusing under other circumstances, Peter and I found ourselves able to respond only with blank looks. "Well, that's great," Danny said. "I just need to see your swipe-out card, sirs, please." Peter handed over his card while I rummaged in the plastic wallet for mine. I had stupidly put it back in there after the last security check, thinking there would be no more. Danny slid each through his little machine and waited until it beeped. He looked up at us, then down at the machine again. Satisfied, he handed back our cards. Peter reached out and took both of them while I struggled to get the plastic wallet to snap shut again. "Mr. Dunn and Mr. Brazier, you are so welcome aboard," Danny said. "You will be staying in two of our deluxe junior suites up on Atlantic Deck, 801 and 803. He pointed with two fingers to a bank of elevators on his left. "Take the C elevators up to 8, turn right and follow the signs. We're serving a buffet lunch in the main dining room on the Oceanic Deck, that's 13, and we start our sail away party at 6 o'clock sharp on Pacific. That's the very top. If you're waiting for luggage, we hope to have it on board very shortly, but if you need anything in the meantime, the Central Park shopping mall on the promenade deck is open. There's also a comfort pack in your cabin, along with more information about the ship and this afternoon's muster drill. Do you have any questions?" We both shook our head. Danny nodded at the swipe-out cards in Peter's hand. "Just so you know, those are both charging back to the same account, but they don't open both cabin doors, so if you mix them up, you might find yourself locked out. Replacements can only be issued with photo ID. Do let the crew know if you have any questions, and again, welcome aboard the Celebrate." "What the hell is a sailaway party?" I asked Peter as soon as we stepped inside the elevator. "It's when the ship sets sail. Everyone goes up on deck to watch dry land disappear." He pressed the button for Atlantic. As the doors slid closed, he turned to face me. "Adam, are you okay?" "Yeah, fine." Peter was staring at me, studying me. "I know it's weird, he said. It's hard not to think. Did she see this? Was she in this elevator? Where's her boarding photo now? I had actually found it easy not to think those things until he brought it up. On the phone, I said, you told me there were things you wanted to wait and tell me in person. Yes, we'll be able to talk soon. I just think it's safer to wait until we know there's no one around to overhear, crew especially. We can talk in one of the cabins. The walls are thin and the balconies share partitions. I think an open deck might be the best option. They're rebranding, I said, holding up the plastic wallet. Some stuff has the old logo, some new. The elevator stopped. Atlantic Deck, an androgynous voice announced. The door slid open on a narrow, brightly lit corridor. Its walls were white, and one long, wavy blue line had been painted along it at waist height, as far as the eye could see. It had the faint smell of seawater, layered with something floral and sickly sweet, like air freshener. We stepped out, turned right, and walked as far as the door marked 801. The door of 803 was right beside it. You're 803, Peter said, handing me one of the cards. Shall I knock on your door and say... He looked at his watch. 20 minutes? We'll find a place to talk then. I said that was fine. And you might want to use your phone while you can. I don't think it will work once we're sailing. Okay. We're going to find him, Adam. Peter was staring at me again with that intense gaze. Uncomfortable in it, I shifted my weight. Yeah, was all I said. But what are we going to do then? 20 minutes, Peter said, and disappeared into 801. I unlocked 803 with my swipe out. A do not disturb sign was hanging from the inside handle. I opened the door again to hang it outside. My cabin was narrow but long and larger than I expected. Everything was blue, yellow or white, or covered in a pattern that incorporated all three. And spotless. With my back to the door, the bathroom was on my immediate right. On my left was a narrow wardrobe. Walking farther into the room, I found a two-seater couch upholstered in blue wave blue, pushed up against one wall and facing a built-in desk with a mirror and flat-screen TV. A little round tray on the desktop held a small bottle of champagne and two glasses, with a spray of blue and yellow ribbon curls tied around the bottle's neck. Every flat surface had a little railing or a raised edge, presumably to keep things from crashing to the floor in stormy seas. The double bed had just enough space between its foot and the opposing wall to allow access to a pair of sliding glass doors, which gave onto the balcony. Was this the kind of cabin Sarah and Ethan had shared? Had they enjoyed a glass of champagne and watched the sunset on a balcony just like the one out there? Had they lain together on a bed like this? Had sex in it? What had happened then? I grabbed the remote control from the bedside table and turned on the TV. It was set to some sort of blue wave info channel. Scenes from The Celebrate were playing in slow fades set to gentle elevator music. Text at the bottom of the screen read, "Welcome aboard, Peter." I looked down at the swipe card I had tossed on the bed and frowned. It said done, but then they both did. Peter must have just mixed them up and taken the cabin assigned to my name instead of his own and handed me the key that opened the one assigned to him. But it didn't matter. They were both the same. I thought nothing more about it at the time. Tell me, Adam, how much do you know about maritime law? Peter and I had found a quiet spot on the Pacific deck, a small bar with its shutters down that faced into a semicircle of tables and tub chairs arranged in the chilly shadow of the ship's funnel. Pop music played unobtrusively from unseen speakers. Happy passengers milled about, clutching glasses topped with impressively cut fruit, while, over the port rail, the cityscape of Barcelona shimmered in the afternoon heat. On the other side of the funnel, in the sun, we had walked past an expansive swimming pool, which was already filling up with children splashing and laughing and throwing inflatable things. I couldn't help but scan the faces of the crew members I found in the crowd. "I only know what Cusack told me," I answered. "The thing about the authority in charge being the authority of the country where the ship is registered, not wherever the ship happens to be." "In charge," Peter scoffed, "if only." She talked about Shane Keating. "Have you heard of him?" "Yes, of course. Tragic, that. You have to feel for the brother." She said a couple of policemen from Barbados were about to head for the Fiesta when the crew realized he'd gone overboard and called in the Coast Guard instead. "Yes." Peter took a sip of his drink and made a face. Two fruity, watered-down cocktails had been thrust in our faces the moment we stepped out on deck. The easiest option had been to accept them. "The thing is, Adam," he stopped, hesitated. "Let me ask you something. What do you think has happened to Sarah?" "I've been trying not to think about it." "Which I can understand. There's no scenario that makes sense." "It seems that way, yes. It's as if I'm walking down a very narrow corridor, and the wall on my right is the best-case scenario. That this is all a misunderstanding of some kind, that Sarah did lose her passport, that there's a logical explanation for the note. That she's been in the hospital or had an episode or something, which explains her absence, but she's going to be absolutely fine. That this guy, Ethan, was just a friend who let her use his employee discount. Then the wall on the left is, well, it's the other end of the scenario spectrum. The worst possible outcome. And while the best case scenario seems implausible at this point, I don't want to believe the worst one until I have to. Until I've no choice but to. So, until then, I'm just walking down this corridor, trying to stay in the middle, trying not to touch either side, even though they're so close there's only inches to spare." I paused. "Sorry, that probably sounds a bit crazy." "Not at all," Peter said. "It makes complete sense, and I know exactly what you mean. I spent enough time in that corridor myself. But those walls. I'm sorry, but I'm about to push you straight into one of them." I didn't have to ask which one. "Your policewoman was right about the Keating case," Peter continued. "The Fiesta, like the Celebrate, is registered in Barbados for tax purposes. So if a crime that took place in international waters needed investigating, two Barbadian police officers would board a plane and head for the ship. A ship filled with thousands of potential suspects and owned by an incredibly powerful corporation. Two of them. On their own. Away from their offices, support staff, etc. And that's if the ship's captain invites them aboard in the first place. Where was that one Shane Keating? The North Atlantic? I think so. It was the Icelandic Coast Guard that got called in, so yeah, it must be. That's, what, 4,000 miles from Barbados, give or take? How long would our two Barbadian PD friends need to get there? Let's say 24 hours. And while they're in a plane over the Atlantic, what's happening back on the ship? The crew could be unwittingly scrubbing potential crime scenes clean. Potential witnesses walk off to take a pleasant day tour, or worse, fly off home. But isn't there somebody on the ship who can start the investigation? I said. Isn't there security on board? There has to be some kind of authority on the ship. There are security guards, Peter said. The same kind you see parading around shopping centres with their thumbs in their belts and the power they think they have already gone to their heads. Blue Wave calls them security officers, but that doesn't make them effective. Or change the fact that they're policing a property they are also supposed to be protecting for their employer, which is a huge conflict of interest. That's why most of the time, crimes aboard cruise ships aren't investigated at all. How can that be? Let's say you were physically assaulted in your cabin and then robbed. What do you do? Go to a security officer. Go to a security officer who may talk to you for a while, take a statement and so on, and then take the matter up to the bridge. There, the captain will decide whether or not to do anything about it. But who says he has to do anything at all? I raise my eyebrows. The law? So who's going to fly two police officers halfway around the world to find the guy who stole your wallet? And assaulted me? That would only draw attention to the incident. You say that like it's a bad thing. To the captain it would be, because he likes having a job. Cruises are supposed to be all fun and frolics at sea. There's nothing about thefts or assaults in the brochures I've seen, or date rape drug incidents for that matter. No mention of sexual assaults. No disappearances. Those things just wouldn't be seemly in a floating paradise. Who'd want to go on a cruise if they thought they were walking into danger? An enclosed space full of it. If something happens, they try to keep it quiet. Most importantly of all, keep it out of the press. How, though? More often than not, these incidents involve a wayward crew member, and crew can be fired. Problem solved. If the victim can be appeased with a free cruise or compensation for medical bills or whatever, better yet. They'll cough up any amount so long as it's kept out of court and you sign a non-disclosure agreement. It's in the cruise company's best interests to sweep all this under the rug and then stand over the bulge, smiling and pretending nothing's wrong. Peter looked around, presumably to make sure we were still alone before he continued. Unless, of course, there's a murder. I flinched. They wouldn't call it a murder, though, Peter said. Not unless they had to. If there's no body, they don't. For a murder, you need a cause of death. Where would the body... I stopped and turned my head toward the starboard rail. There it was. Endless sea. The perfect dumping ground, Peter said. If you pushed someone off a balcony in the middle of the night, who would even know? No one, until morning, when that person's absence is noticed. If it is. It might take longer if the person were travelling alone. They might not be missed at all until the end of the cruise. Meanwhile, the cabin attendants are cleaning away all the forensic evidence and the ship's sailing farther and farther away from the body's location. The other passengers are oblivious. It's as if it never happened at all. Except that a person is missing, I said. Peter clicked his fingers. Exactly. That's just it. There's no evidence of a murder, but a person is missing. And what's a missing person minus a body? Not a murder. Oh no, never a murder. That's called a disappearance. The word hung in the air. I steeled myself. You're saying... No, I couldn't say it. Estelle didn't disappear, Adam. I know it. There's no possible way she would have walked off this ship and decided never to come back to her life, never to come back to me. She would never have left me living like this, in this hell of not knowing. And wouldn't you say exactly the same thing about Sarah? But Sarah did walk off it. Peter said nothing for a full 3 seconds. Then gently, how do you know that? Because Blue Wave told me, I said. They showed me. What did they show you? The key card activity. The swipe out card thing. A piece of paper, you mean? Yeah. With things printed on it. What else could they have produced? How about some CCTV? How about moving images? time and date stamped of Sarah getting off the ship when they say she did. Every inch of the ship has cameras pointed on it. That tender platform was probably covered from every angle. Why not show you that?
Maybe it was because I didn't think to ask them for it.
Well, I bloody well did, Adam. I asked them for it.
More than once.
I took them to court to ask them for it, and they still said no. Why? Could it be because they don't have any? Could it be because there's no footage of Estelle getting off the ship? Could it be that she never did?
If she didn't walk off the ship, I said, then where did she go?
I think she's with Sarah. I think the same person took them both.
In the narrow corridor in my mind, the wall on the left was rushing toward my face. I closed my eyes.
It seems like no scenario makes sense, Peter said. But one does. Unfortunately, it's the one we don't want to think about.
When I opened my eyes again, a British passport was on the tabletop between us.
The envelope got thrown away, Peter said, but it was postmarked Nice, too. Sent 2 days after I last saw Estelle. The same day she supposedly got off the ship.
I picked it up and flicked through it. It was the same in all the ways that mattered. The sticky note, the new Blue Wave logo, the two words. But this note was signed E.
Like you, Peter said. I didn't know what to make of it when it arrived. But I knew something had happened to her. Something awful. I knew it from the moment her friend Becky called to tell me they couldn't find her on the ship. So this,
he lifted his chin to indicate the passport,
was a torment. A piece of the puzzle I couldn't get to fit. The note, it's in Estelle's writing, definitely. And you said you were sure the writing on yours was Sarah's, right?
I nodded but didn't speak. I wasn't sure I could.
So we have two women, Peter went on, who don't know each other, who have no connection to each other, last seen in the same place 1 year apart. Here, on this ship. They both write exactly the same words on exactly the same type of paper and stick them in their passports. And then, somehow, those passports find their way to you and me, the men who love them. Postmarked Nice, where Blue Wave says they walked off the ship. How can that possibly be a coincidence? And then you find me and find out that Sarah came aboard with a man who works here, a man who would know this ship and the rules that govern it like the back of his hand.
Ethan.
He's the connection, Peter said. He's the one who did this.
Into the wall. Face first. Tell me what happened, I said weakly. My tongue felt thick and bristly, my throat tight and dry. Tell me what happened to Estelle. Estelle Brazier was 32 on August 3rd, 2013, the day she disappeared from the Celebrate. She had boarded the ship in Barcelona the day before in a group of 10 women. Among them was Becky Richardson, Estelle's closest friend. They had known each other since they were toddlers. It was a last-minute thing, Peter explained. The trip was actually a bachelorette party for one of Becky's colleagues. Only 3 days before, one of the women broke her leg in a cycling accident and had to drop out. She was supposed to be Becky's cabin mate, so Becky was asked if she knew anyone else who might be able to come along instead on short notice. It was already paid for, no refunds. Estelle wangled a few days off work and off she went. I often think, what if that other woman hadn't fallen off her bike? None of this would have happened. Doesn't the world turn on such small, small things? Had Estelle ever been on a cruise before? I asked.
No, never. It wasn't really our kind of thing. To be honest, I didn't want her to go.
Why?
I just didn't think she would enjoy it. Becky was the only one in the group she knew well. She'd never even met most of the others before. And stuck with them all on a ship, drinking and being silly and running around with veils on? He shook his head. That wasn't Estelle. But she must have wanted to go. Peter's face hardened. Becky wanted her to go. That's why she went. I figured he wasn't a big Becky fan these days. Understandable, after what happened. They flew out from Gatwick together, he said. Boarded the Celebrate here early on a Thursday afternoon. I think the ship had been in service barely a month at that stage. Still a few teething problems. Lifts breaking down, a wave pool not open yet, glitches in the dining reservation system, things like that. They spent a few hours sunbathing by the grotto pool and had a late lunch in the Cabana Cafe alongside it. Then they all went back to their cabins to get ready for the evening, before meeting up again around 8 in the Showcase Theatre on the Oceanic deck to watch a variety show. After that, they went to Fizz. It's a cocktail bar. The way Peter talked about the Celebrate reminded me of Titanic documentaries I'd watched where talking heads, historians, enthusiasts, director James Cameron, spoke of the A corridor and the Grand Staircase and Orlop Deck, as if these were places they had been visiting all their lives. Places they knew so well, they could navigate them in the dark. This despite the fact that the ship had sunk long before any of them were born. Accounts, and not coincidentally, inebriation levels, varied regarding what happened next, but it was generally agreed that sometime between 10:45 p.m. and 11:10 p.m. on that first night at sea, Estelle told the others she had developed a bad headache. One of the women would recall her looking grey and sweaty, while another said she was slurring her words. She wasn't drinking alcohol, Peter said, so we're talking about the effects of something else. My guess is either Estelle had something slipped into her drink or she was getting a migraine. She did suffer from those from time to time. Either way, she told Becky she was going to go buy some aspirin, lie down for an hour, and then come back to the bar if she was feeling well enough. But she didn't come back. She wasn't in the cabin when Becky went back to it. Becky spent the night in one of the group's other cabins so as not to disturb Estelle. When she finally did go back to theirs, it was nearly 9 the next morning and Estelle wasn't there. Had she slept there? The bed was made. Becky assumed housekeeping had come and gone. They were already tendered at Villefranche by then, and the plan for the day was to take a private bus tour around the coast. The driver was meeting them at the ferry terminal at 10:30. They all assumed that Estelle, being the only one among them who had had an early night, had gotten up early and gone ashore. They thought she had figured on meeting them there. What about her phone? Becky called it, but it went straight to voicemail. She thought maybe the phone hadn't managed to connect to a service in France. But when they got ashore and realised Estelle wasn't in Villefranche, Becky went back to the ship, to the cabin, had another look at the bed. She realised then it hadn't been remade because it was never disturbed in the first place. And then she found the phone. Estelle's phone was in the cabin. Yes, Peter said grimly. It was a sign of the times that this detail seemed more significant than all the rest. I said, what about the rest of Estelle's stuff? All her clothes and cosmetics were still there, many of them still in her suitcase. So was the aspirin that she'd presumably bought after leaving Fizz. Unopened. No sign of her swipe-out card. A pause. Or the passport, of course. Becky alerted a security officer, Peter explained, who brought her to the bridge to speak to his superior. A shipwide announcement was made over the PA system asking Estelle to make herself known to a crew member. By now, time was ticking on. It was almost 1 o'clock, and no one had seen Estelle since around 11 the night before. It was at this point that Becky really started to worry, Peter said, mostly because the crew seemed to be taking it quite seriously. There was talk of conducting a cabin-to-cabin search. With most of the passengers already on the coast, now was the time to do it. But then, all of a sudden, the cruise director shows up, brings Becky into a little room and says it's all right. Panic's over. Estelle got off the ship this morning. He gave her this. Peter reached into his pocket and pulled out a letter-sized sheet of paper folded in quarters. Estelle's swipe-out activity, he said, handing it to me. Yeah, I said. I got one too. I quickly scanned the page, a dense, tidy list of dates, times, and what I presumed were point-of-sale locations on the Celebrate. Three lines at the end had been highlighted in neon yellow, and alongside them, in the margins, were notations in handwriting. 03-08-13 11-23 4814 CB CRES Crescent CB equals chargeback tablets 03-08-13 11-59 2391 AP 7012 Access point. 40 minutes. ? 040813. 7:28. 9281. ID. TENPLT 4. Tender/ID check. CCTV ? According to this, Peter said, Estelle entered her cabin a minute before midnight on Thursday, then got off the ship and onto a tender at 28 minutes past 7 the next morning. So they faked this? I said, waving the piece of paper. Not necessarily. I think Estelle's swipe-out card got off the ship. Think about it. How hard would it be for a crew member to sidle up to one of his colleagues at the tender platform and distract him for a few seconds, long enough to slide a card through one of those handheld machines? In my mind's eye, I saw Ethan doing just that. Unlike Cusack's explanations, this theory actually made sense. Unfortunately. That would explain Blue Wave's willingness to let you have the swipe-out activity, I said, but not the CCTV. Yes, he nodded encouragingly. Exactly, Adam. Yes, indeed. He seemed relieved. Yes, relieved that I was agreeing with him. But then, this was probably the first time he had told anyone this and got a response other than pity or maybe a tactful query about his mental health. What's their excuse, though? I asked. I mean, what does Blue Wave say when you ask to have a look at the CCTV? Officially, the footage contains sensitive operational procedures. Peter rolled his eyes at the phrase. And they tell me that if I'm looking for evidence that Estelle got off the ship, I already have it. But what I actually have is evidence that something happened to her while she was aboard. I looked at the printout.